The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The shocking, infuriating story about COVID, how economies were shut down, businesses were destroyed, lives ruined, people killed, and for what? To hide the truth about who unleashed this virus on the world. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
It's time for us to get informed and also for us to get really angry. Quite honestly, I'm very angry. Why? Because it turns out that this COVID-19 scandal is much, much bigger than we thought, much scarier than we thought, and it implicates some of the highest people in our government. At first, we thought that this COVID scandal was a scandal of a virus that was being exploited by the Democrats for election purposes to impose unnecessary lockdowns. We were skeptical of the health establishment, which seems to have been recruited by the left into making implausible claims about the virus. You have to have 6 feet of social distancing. You have to have a mask, as if a piece of towel across your face is going to keep the virus out. You've got to lock down these businesses, including the churches. So we thought this is excessive. This does not seem to be a reasonable response. And why are you blocking proposed remedies, things that might actually help, hydroxychloroquine and so on? We thought this is what the scandal was all about. It turns out it is actually much, much bigger. So what is the real story of COVID-19? Well, the facts are emerging now, but they're emerging explosively. Seems that the real story of COVID-19 involves not just China, not just the Wuhan lab, not just the Chinese Communist Party, but involves a powerful network of American virologists who were getting money to do this so-called gain-of-function research, to create deadly viruses, make them more deadly. The U.S. government was in on it, was funding them using taxpayer money. There were powerful people in the health agencies of government, the NIH, Dr. Fauci, giving money to these people. And when COVID-19 exploded, when it came out, and people began to get sick and began to die, first in China, but then all over the world, these powerful people quickly realized that the blame was going to turn on them. Why? Because the outbreak in Wuhan is right next door to the Wuhan labs. And the Wuhan labs isn't one lab. It's a kind of network of labs. Now, only one of those labs operates according to the highest levels of biosecurity. The other labs are basically like dental offices, and yet they're doing this so-called gain-of-function research also. And by the way, the Wuhan labs function in collaboration with the Chinese military. The Chinese military is involved with the Wuhan lab, which means that there's a kind of exchange of information, and the Chinese military is kept appraised of the possibilities of deadly viruses for military purposes. Now, once coronavirus got out, these powerful people in America realized that they were getting money, taxpayer money, government money, to do this dangerous research. Something had gone terribly wrong, whether intentionally or deliberately, let's leave aside for the moment. But they realized that the blame was going to fall on them. Wuhan outbreak, Wuhan lab. Who are the people collaborating with the Wuhan lab? So these people realize this is going to be like Chernobyl. I mean, you remember how the Chernobyl accident, and of course earlier the Three Mile Island accident involving nuclear power, basically shut down the nuclear industry. So these people realize that's going to happen to us. This whole idea of virologists making deadly viruses, kind of what we do, what would be open now, not only to scrutiny, but to blame. And the public will be mobilized, and the people with the pitchforks are going to be coming and demand to know what's going on. And they realize we need to shut down this whole line of inquiry. In fact, we sort of need to shut down the world. Why? Because if people can't move around, if they're stuck in their homes, if they're all operating like robots with masks on their faces, do this, do that, walk around like a zombie, essentially you shut down not just their mobility, but their critical faculties. It's difficult to communicate. And by the way, if you can get the digital corporations behind you, then they can shut down anybody who does speak up. So what essentially happened is that you got very powerful people both inside the U.S. government and in the community of virologists, figuring out a way to create a false blame. To say, hey, this virus, it occurs in nature. So there's no real reason to get angry. It's sort of like a hurricane. You can't get angry at the hurricane. That's just nature. And so they said, let's blame the Wuhan meat market. Now, in fact, they knew something that all medical experts know, and that is that, by and large, meat markets generally don't generate deadly outbreaks in the dead of winter. Why? Because the bats are in hibernation. The bats are unlikely to be the original source. So here you have a Wuhan market that, by the way, doesn't even sell bats. So the bat would have somehow, these bats would have to have awoken from their sleep, given the virus to some other animals. Those animals would have to be the origin of the spread. Possible, but extremely unlikely. And but yet these virologists decided, we're virologists. I mean, we're the guys with the white coats. So now The Lancet, which happens to be one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, publishes this public statement, very strongly worded, basically saying, expressing solidarity with health professionals and saying, quote, we stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin. So the idea here is that it does have a natural origin. And all these prominent virologists signed it, and it seemed to sort of set the tone that any scientist, any virologist who says otherwise is peddling conspiracy theories. Now, I learned from a new article in Vanity Fair, and I've got to give credit to Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair normally publishes all kinds of rubbish, all kinds of dubious theories and so on, but they've got an in-depth, it's 20 or 30 pages in the magazine, beautifully researched, heavily sourced, credible article. And they point out that this Lancet statement was organized by a guy who is a massive investor in gain-of-function research. This guy's name is Peter Daszak. Peter Daszak was the organizer of this statement. Now, you might ask, how does a guy, Peter Daszak, have the clout to put a statement like this together? Well, the answer is, when federal money goes to American labs, these American labs control a whole network of virologists because they disperse that federal money out to all a researcher over here, a researcher over there. So they've got all these virologists in their back pocket. Now, another guy who's very actively involved in this gain-of-function research is a guy named Dr. Ralph Baric. Dr. Ralph Baric is the guy who was the direct beneficiary through his organization called Eco Health Alliance. He was getting the federal money. And Baric was the guy basically working directly with Wuhan. So this is another guy who's in the front of this, another guy who has a direct self-interest in it. And so Daszak and Baric are the two guys together, in a sense, organizing this statement. And here's where you know that their motives are malicious. Why? Because Daszak emails Baric, and he goes, no need for you to sign the statement, Ralph. And I'm now going to quote him. He goes, you and me should not sign this statement. So it has some distance from us and therefore doesn't work in a counterproductive way. What he's getting at is, let's put all these front men, other virologists out front. Let's keep your name and mine off the signatory list. Why? Because that way there will appear to be no self-interest involved. These virologists were speaking objectively with the authority of science, whereas in fact, the two guys organizing the statement have a direct self-interest. They're the ones getting the money. They're the ones that the blame would fall on if there is blame to fall. And Baric agrees, by the way. He goes, yeah, I'm not going to sign it either. He goes, otherwise it looks self-serving. You know why it looks self-serving? Because it is self-serving. So Baric ultimately didn't sign the statement. In the end, the other guy, Daszak, did. But we now know why they put it out. So this is only the sort of beginning of the story. One other tidbit for this segment, and then I'll go into this in more depth. Robert Redfield, the head of the CDC under Trump, began to suspect that something was wrong here. Why? Because Dr. Redfield got a call from a Chinese scientist, a fellow named George Fu Gao, head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control. And this guy told Robert Redfield, I've been looking at these cases and this meat market explanation makes absolutely no sense. And so Redfield went on CNN and he said, you know, I'm beginning to suspect that COVID-19 may have come from a lab. He does this in late March. Now, very interestingly, at this point, Redfield says he started getting death threats. From whom? Not from random activists, not from Antifa people, from scientists. Scientists began to call him and threaten his life, if you can believe it. So what this means, really, is that... And a couple of these people, Redfield says he knew they were his friends. I'm now quoting Redfield in Vanity Fair. I expected it from politicians. I didn't expect it from science. So what you're getting at here is that there's a powerful scientific establishment and lobby that gets huge amounts of taxpayer money. And all these people felt threatened because they were sort of like nuclear scientists who are trying to cover up a nuclear accident. It's extremely important for them to go after people who point the finger of blame at them or who point the spotlight toward them. It's extremely important for them to shut those lines of inquiry down. And then there's, of course, the deeply corrupt role of digital media, because the digital media moguls were in on it. If you just look at the Fauci emails, look at the extent of his connections to Chris Cuomo, for example, at CNN. Regular emails to Cuomo. Look at his connections to Bill Gates. Look at his connections to Mark Zuckerberg. And you ask yourself, what's Fauci doing exchanging information with Zuckerberg? Well, the answer is Fauci realizes that part of the way you control this narrative, part of the way you keep blame away from the scientific community that's directly implicated here is you cultivate powerful friends. You put on your lab coat so they all get the idea that you're just speaking for science. They all obviously want to be, you know, they want to be helpful. They want to do the right thing. And so you convince them that doing the right thing in this case is shutting all your critics down, banning them, pulling down their posts. And Facebook, as we know now, pulled down tens of millions of posts. Posts that were raising legitimate possibilities, legitimate debate on the biggest issue in the world, an issue that's devastated the world economy, an issue that's actually propelled China's rise to a virtual status of a competing superpower with the United States, that's destroyed lives, that's put relatives in graves, that's shut down our lives, that's subtracted almost 2 years of our lives. All of this, it now appears in retrospect, was done. Why? To cover up the culpability of a small cabal, well, not so small, of powerful people in science and in government and at the National Institutes of Health and also in other places in the U.S. government. We'll talk about that more in the next segment. A massive cover up. And quite honestly, when you have major scientists organizing letters and keeping their names slyly off them, this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is, in fact, an actual conspiracy. I'm talking about the massive cover-up of how coronavirus was unleashed into the world. And it now appears that all lines of evidence point in one direction, namely to the Wuhan lab and to the people who were helping the Wuhan lab, American researchers working in collaboration with the American government, the U.S. government, using taxpayer money. And it was to cover this up, to prevent this from coming to public light. Think about it. We're talking about things like gain-of-function research, making deadly viruses. We heard none about this, nothing about this for a year and a half. Fauci knew about it. He just didn't want us to know about it. So he never said a word. His internal emails and memos show he's fully aware of all this. In fact, he's behind it. He himself is funding this kind of, he supports it. But of course, he knew that if he talks about it, people will go, wait a minute, is it possible really that you are not the solution, but the problem here? Now, this is a story with some heroes. And the heroes are very unlikely. It's kind of interesting for me to discover them in Vanity Fair. First of all, Vanity Fair kind of reluctantly concedes that some of the heroes are in the Trump administration. The CDC director, Robert Redfield, who said early on, hey, I smell a rat. I think this may have come from Wuhan. Or Trump himself, who said it probably having been briefed by Redfield. And Trump was right. And then Mike Pompeo, by the way, who was leading to the very end, before the Trump administration exited the scene, an investigation on the part of the NSC and the State Department into how where this virus started. But this investigation, very interestingly, was also unleashed by some random skeptics around the world. Not part of the medical establishment. The medical establishment had been shut down by a series of letters in the Lancet, also statements by the World Health Organization that this virus had a natural origin. This was actually manifestly false. In other words, they didn't know that it did, but they said that it did. However, very early on, there was a young researcher in China who basically said, put out a paper on the internet saying that it made no sense to attribute the virus to the meat market. It obviously came from either the Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention or the Wuhan Institute of Virology, kind of two twin institutes, both, of course, in Wuhan. But as soon as the paper appeared on the internet, it went down, which is to say digital media censored it. And this is how digital media, pretending to correct misinformation, becomes, in fact, the chief enforcer of misinformation, shutting down valid theories. Now, it turns out that a group of researchers in Europe, Dr. Philippa Lensos, a biosecurity expert at the King's College in London, a group of French researchers called the Paris Group. These guys, about 30 of them, began to do Zoom calls with each other because they realized we're being lied to. We're not actually being given the true story. One of them, in fact, Dr. Lensos, wrote eventually an article in 2020 in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists saying, listen, here's how this pathogen could have escaped from the lab. Not that it did escape, but here's how it could have happened. In other words, we don't need to shut down a theory that's a real theory. Alina Chan, who is, by the way, a postdoctoral fellow at MIT and Harvard, said that if you look carefully at COVID-19, it shows very little evidence of sort of natural mutation. It looks more like it is, quote, pre-adapted to human transmission. In other words, made to be infectious by humans. Made, in other words, in a lab. There was also a researcher, a former science teacher in Eastern India. And this guy began to dig in and he found something amazing. He basically found that there was a bat-filled mine shaft in the Yunnan province in China where the Wuhan people had been collecting bats and extracting viruses. And what this guy found is that the data from this bat collection had been hidden by the Chinese government. The Wuhan Institute, in fact, had taken down an entire database off the internet, providing ultimately what the findings of its own research were. So let's think about it. The Wuhan people take down the database, and thus the database is only available to them and to the Chinese military. Now, the World Health Organization, in which sort of comical stupidity, goes down there to, quote, investigate. And this investigation, and the Vanity Fair article makes this completely clear, is a complete fraud. First of all, there's only one American in this group. Guess who? Peter Daszak, the very guy funding gain-of-function research who has a direct interest in blaming the meat market. He's the only American in this group. They go down there, and the Chinese control everything. The Chinese control what they can see. The Chinese provide no data. The World Health Organization guys don't even really ask for data. In fact, the Chinese say to them that according to the WHO resolution, the mission was not to find out where COVID came from, very interestingly, but simply, quote, to identify the zoonotic source of the virus. Think about this. The WHO's mission is to find out what is the natural cause of COVID-19. They assume that there is a natural cause. They don't even investigate the alternative possibilities. Kind of like saying, go find out how this guy with a bullet through his head died by accident. They don't even open up the possibility, did someone in fact kill him? So what you have here is this so-called World Health Organization investigation that's really not an investigation at all. And then we have all the people in the government. Christopher Park, the director of the State Department's biological policy staff, he tells people in the government, don't say anything that has to do with the U.S. government's own role in supporting gain-of-function research. This is the U.S. government covering up for itself. So he doesn't want anyone in the government talking to the media or to the public that we, the U.S. government, are paying for this stuff. And then Chris Ford, the acting undersecretary for arms control and international security. This is a guy who warned people in his bureau, quote, not to pursue an investigation into the origin of COVID-19 because, quote, it would open up a can of worms. Boom. Who says this? This is Thomas DiNano, the former acting secretary of state. He verifies that Chris Ford is basically saying, let's not get into how this COVID thing got started because the blame may turn out to point right to us. Let's cover it up. So, interestingly, what has been dismissed as a conspiracy theory may very well turn out to be an actual conspiracy. There's a lot more to say about all this, but what I will say for now is we should be furious. We should recognize that these people wrecked our lives to protect their own misdeeds. Some of these people need to be indicted and arrested and end up in jail. At the very least, I'll say that we now know that they are lying. And by the way, they know that we know. But they're still kind of doing it. Interestingly, a new trove of Fauci's emails became available, and the group that got them, Twitter took them down recently, now. So the censorship continues, the lie continues, the bad guys are still around, and if we don't hold them accountable, they will feel that sense of immunity, and they will do it to us all over again. I'm excited to be heading out next weekend to Minnesota to join Mike Lindell and a whole bunch of people, Diamond and Silk and others. Trump is going to be checking in from Florida, a huge rally for free speech. And this is Mike Lindell. He puts himself on the line. And I want to do whatever I can and whatever we can to support this guy. So I've come up with this new idea. I just introduced it this week. I'm delighted so many of you are taking me up on it. This is to go all out to help Mike Lindell and in the process get some great products. But not just Mike's products, mine too. So I call this the Dinesh Book and Movie Deal. Now, I haven't mentioned it to Mike Lindell so far. He knows nothing about it. Here's the deal. You go all out and buy $250, $500, or $1,000 of MyPillow merchandise. Hey, you've got a house. This guy has stuff for all over your house. It's not hard to do. He has 100 great products from his classic premium MyPillows, the Giza Dream Sheets for your beds, the MyPillow robes, the MyPillow mattress topper, the MyPillow slippers, the MyPillow dog beds. The list goes on. So here's the fun part. If you spend $250, I'll send you a copy of one of my very recent books, very topical, one of my favorites, personally autographed to you. If you spend $500, you get 2 signed books plus 2 of my movies. If you spend $1,000 or more, well, you get the sort of the Dinesh special, 4 signed books, 4 movies, a kind of mini Dinesh collection. So let's show Mike what we can do for him and get some great books and movies in the bargain. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. You have to use the promo code to get the books and to get these discounts. Now, what else do you have to do to get the books? Well, nothing. I'll get your information from the MyPillow people and send the books to the same address that you use to get your merchandise. Now, this offer ends July 4th, so act now. Again, that number is 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code Dinesh. I'm really happy to have Sohrab Ahmari as a guest on the podcast. Sohrab is the op-ed editor of the New York Post, but he's not an ordinary journalist. He's also a real thinker, and Sohrab has published an important book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos, a book that is a bestseller, but it's also a book that is full of meaty content. Sohrab, thanks for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Let me ask you this. Your family emigrated to America from Iran, and it seems that that experience through your family is part of what inspired you to think in a different way about the meaning of freedom. Say a word about how your family's experience has affected you, and maybe what that had to do with you framing your book in this way.
Yeah, sure. So I came from I was born into a very secular, liberal family in post-revolutionary Iran. And what that meant was that a lot of our life was defined in opposition to the Islamic Republic, which is a brutal theocracy. And for a lot of Iranians of my and my parents' milieu, what that led to is a belief that, well, if tradition is the Islamic Republic, then all tradition is bad, basically. And we thought of the United States as a society that is ultra-individualistic, rational, quote-unquote, meaning unhindered by the superstition of religion in the past. And that was the worldview that I adopted for much of my teenage years and into my 20s. But then, you know, as I grew a little bit older, I began to question that, and question that account of freedom, whether that was sufficient for a really good society, and especially became acute when I became a father. Well, first of all, when I became a Christian, and then when I became a father, where I worry that the account of freedom that prevails in contemporary America, that says freedom just means, you know, having the maximal amount of choice and getting ahead in life and generally just pleasing yourself in various ways, is a sufficient account of freedom in terms of what I pass on to my son, Max.
Sohrab, you mentioned becoming a Christian, and what was the single most important thought or experience that caused you to do that? I mean, as you say, when you came to America, it's almost like you had identified with this sort of notion of choice, of freedom, of doing what you will, as in opposition to the kind of theocratic approach of Iran. What made you say, wait a minute, the Christian tradition, the Christian beliefs, that's something I want to embrace?
So the biggest stumbling block for me was just coming to believe in a personal God, because I had declared myself an atheist while living under the Ayatollahs, because, again, I associated God with judicial amputations and floggings and so forth. So then I thought all religion is this kind of backwardness. But once I came to believe in a personal God, and the way I did that, I guess I could say God's action is his grace, but my response to it was through reasoning, and that reasoning came via the conscience, the fact that I had this interior voice pointed me to try to do good and to avoid evil, which then suggested that there's some objective moral order into the world, and human beings are inherently called to bring themselves into adherence with that order. I read Pope Benedict's books, I read the Bible, it's kind of there's an intellectual formation there, and ultimately came to conclude that that interior voice of the conscience and that evidence for an objective moral order points to the existence of a personal God. From there to accepting a God of the Bible was much easier, and so that was a real definitive.
You know, Sohrab, I was just reading a few lines from Paul's letter to the Romans, and something struck me that I hadn't quite seen in there before, which is that Paul says basically that the knowledge of God through conscience and through the world is sort of impressed on every human soul. Paul implies, in other words, that there's no such thing as genuine atheism, that even the atheist deep down knows that there is a God. Now, he might be in open rebellion against God and might be recruiting his rational faculties to make the case against God. But I guess Paul's point is that the faculties are being employed as troops, as armored divisions to justify something that he already believes. Do you think that's true?
And of course I do, because I believe that Paul was an inspired author, but you're referring to Romans chapter 1, and that's a critical line, I think, for the field of natural theology. That is, what you can know about God without the benefit of revelation. What St. Paul's saying there is you can, even the pagans, which he's referring to, had a responsibility to, or did, in fact, recognize God, because how else would they explain the orderly nature around them? So obviously Aristotle achieved precisely what St. Paul talks about in chapter one by ultimately concluding that there must be some uncaused cause behind all of the orderly changes that we observe around us.
I think one of the fascinating things, Sohrab, about your book is that your defense of tradition isn't just a defense of sort of one particular tradition, but it seems that in a kind of synthetic, or maybe I could say Catholic, using the small c sense of the term, you draw on Judaism, you draw on Confucianism, you seem to, in a sense, appropriate from the world's traditions a set of shared principles that you think can form the moral anchor of a healthy society. Talk for a moment about why you decided to do that.
Right. So as a Christian, I obviously adhere to capital T tradition, which is a very specific source of authority, the church fathers and so forth. But I, obviously, precisely because of the bit you read in St. Paul, many other civilizations have been granted through their natural reason lots of access to the natural law, to ethics, to how to order a political society properly, even if they don't have the benefit of Judeo-Christian revelation. And so I'm very clear about my commitments that ultimately I'm a Christian, but someone who thinks that natural reason is a powerful force in the world can also draw on Confucianism. The Confucian teaching about filiality, for example, of respect for mother and father, accords not just with natural law, but it then is mirrored in the divine law in the Mosaic commandment to honor your mother and father. So I do keep open that there are certain tensions between the traditions I draw on. So Seneca, I bring in, he was way too comfortable with suicide, and I disagree with him there. But and St. Augustine, who is also a character in the book, absolutely, and then spends the first few chapters of The City of God inveighing against suicide. But there is, as you said, this kind of ecumenical, I hate the word, but there's no better word, this kind of ecumenical wisdom sprinkled among the nations that a person can cohere together in a kind of traditionalist project.
When we come back, I'm going to ask Sohrab Ahmari about his young son and why he fears that the sort of world's definition or America's definition of success is not what he wants for his son. We'll be right back. I want to talk to you about a movie that you need to see, a movie that connects to the idea of being a father. Now, for many Americans, Father's Day is a day to celebrate, but for many others, it's a day to get through. Why? Because Father's Day hurts if you don't have a father. Now, the facts are clear. Fatherlessness drives many bad outcomes in America, from teen pregnancy to incarceration. An astounding 85% of youths in prison come from fatherless homes. That's 20 times the national average. But there is a path forward from the grim statistics, and that's why I want you to order a powerful new film called The Streets Were My Father. The Streets Were My Father. It features the journey of three inner city Chicago men from fatherlessness to gangs and from life in prison to prison ministry programs that set them on the road to redemption and lives as productive members of society. Now, here's a short clip. Listen.
I desired to have a father who would tell me that what I did was wrong.
Debbie and I both saw the film. It's very authentic, very real, brought a tear to both of our eyes. Now, to see this important and inspirational film, the streaming version and DVDs, go to salemnow.com and buy a copy or copies for anyone you know who doesn't have a father or doesn't believe in the power of God to change lives. Once again, go to salemnow.com. That's salemnow.com. I'm back with Sohrab Ahmari, the op-ed editor of the New York Post and the author of an important book that you should get called The Unbroken Thread. Sohrab, you talk early on in the book about a scenario for your son who's very little, but as he grows up, he becomes kind of this hedge fund guy or this publishing guy. He's into this and that. He's into spirituality and yoga. He's heading off to Europe with his girlfriend. They've got a brand new SUV. Now, many people would say, oh, man, Sohrab, you're really lining up your kid for success. But you say that if Maximilian were to do this, you would not necessarily regard it as success. And part of what you're getting at is that there is an understanding of freedom and of success that we hear from liberalism, and we'll come to the meaning of that term, that you reject. So talk for a moment about why, if Maximilian lived this kind of secular, eclectic, cool, woke life, this is something that would give you anxiety rather than parental pride.
Right, and that's the impetus for writing the book, is he's named after St. Maximilian Kolbe, who's this great Franciscan friar who was canonized as a saint for laying down his life for a stranger at Auschwitz. And I begin by telling that story and then turning to the scenario that you summarized there of a Max that's morally purposeless. He has kept his life, his options open his whole life, but it means that he actually hasn't exercised his true freedom. He hasn't bound himself to anything greater than himself. St. Maximilian Kolbe, his namesake, in a Nazi death camp, exercised this true freedom by, which looks like an apparent surrender, laying down his life for a stranger. And at that moment, he's the freest man in Europe in some sense. Whereas my Max, in my kind of nightmare scenario, you know, he's been dating this girl for 10 years, but they kind of never get married, never have children, which is unfortunately all too typical of kind of elites in our milieu today. And so the paradox is that in the name of freedom, he's never reduced all of his options into one definitive commitment to the good life, the truly good life, the married life, family, honor, duty, service, nothing. He's just sort of self-serving himself. And that's not an implausible scenario. It's how a lot of our kind of urban liberal elites live today.
Let me tell the Maximilian Kolbe story just so people get a clear idea of what you're talking about. The Nazis are almost randomly, they come up to one guy in the group and they go, okay, we're going to kill you. And the guy begins to cry and scream and say, hey, listen, I'm a family man. I've got kids. Please don't kill me. And this priest, Maximilian Kolbe, steps forward and he goes, I'll go in his stead. And the Nazis are like, well, okay. And they kill him. And the man lives, right? He lives beyond the death camps, and he becomes ultimately, I think he was a witness in the canonization of Maximilian Kolbe, if I remember correctly. So this becomes then your model. And I think what's really interesting is you're basically saying that ultimately what matters isn't freedom, but how you choose your freedom. In other words, it's the content of your choices, the kind of life you choose to live. The freedom is merely a procedure that allows you to do that. But you're saying if you make bad choices and you essentially become a celebrator of freedom itself, that's not really the end goal. The end goal is something that's beyond freedom. Am I correctly summarizing your thesis?
Absolutely, Dinesh. So the account of freedom that you just laid out, and which is exemplified in a kind of iconic, emotionally overwhelming way in the life of St. Maximilian Kolbe, is just the pre-modern account of freedom, that freedom really means freedom to do what you ought to do, freedom to choose for the good. And in fact, freedom for evil was not called liberty, it was called license. And this, by the way, is a distinction that our founding fathers possessed as well, or at least the more religious ones like John Adams. You know, the idea being that when you're choosing for evil, you're degrading yourself, your fellow human beings. You're attaching yourself to these base appetites, and you ultimately become less free. And there's a kind of this paradox where license leads to unfreedom, St. John says, you know, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin. It's a very short summary of this classical and Christian idea of freedom that I champion throughout the book.
Yeah, let's push that a little bit to make it a little bit more clear. Isn't the idea here that the human being is a mix of higher and lower impulses? And so, for example, I may have, you know, a lust to dominate other people, or I may have an appetite for more, or I may be seething with envy or with resentment. And these are part of me, but they're not necessarily the best part of me. And so the idea of self-government is that the rational and moral nature of the human being needs to exercise some supervisory authority over these lower impulses, because otherwise, by submitting to them, far from being more free, you become a creature that is enslaved to those appetites. Isn't that the traditional view, that self-government doesn't just mean voting in a democratic system? Self-government also means governing yourself.
Literally governing the self. So it is important. It's good to have a political situation in which there aren't tyrants ruling over the people. But that's ultimately, in the classical telling, broadly speaking, is possible only if the people themselves, first of all, have they can govern the interior tyrant, or they can control the interior tyrant. So that, or as St. Augustine says, if you want to have rule over the rule of a rational body over the city, that begins with the rule of the citizens' souls over their kind of baser impulses as well. So, yeah, no, you're summarizing that quite rightly.
You mentioned Solzhenitsyn in the book, I think, in a beautiful passage where you discuss one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich. I'm a little struck by something that Solzhenitsyn says. It's not in the book, but Solzhenitsyn said something like, I was never freer than when I was in the camps, which is to say in these essentially slave camps or concentration camps. But I think what Solzhenitsyn meant is that while they can get to the outward me, they can beat me, they can push me, they can feed me this or feed me that, the inner part of me remains, they can't get to that, and I'm in control of that. So to that degree, there's a certain type of freedom that we never give up, even if we're under external subjugation.
Yes, and you know, as you know, Dinesh, Solzhenitsyn, after he escaped to the West, became an exile here, was asked to give this famous commencement address at Harvard in 1978. And a lot of people just expected him to decry the horrors of the Soviet Union, which, of course, he detested and had been had done so much to expose. But he spent most of this speech criticizing what he saw as the deformation of the Western idea of freedom, which had basically habituated everyone to just kind of self-maximize at that low level of freedom that you're talking about, and snuffed out the higher part of men and women. In the camps, he saw this very clearly, in the sense that you're in a situation where the range of choices you have in a gulag are very narrow. You don't get to pick what you eat, what you do during the day. Nevertheless, he saw in these different character types that some people were able to, even within that narrow margin, really kind of shine heroically as and display what it means to be truly human, what it means to be rational, what it means to be moral. And some people, kind of totally give in to the base side of themselves and compound their exterior imprisonment with a kind of interior imprisonment.
When we come back, I'm going to talk to Sohrab Omari about, are we too far gone, or can we as a culture recover this higher part of ourselves? We'll be right back. Debbie and I have gotten to know Dr. Douglas Howard. He founded the company Balance of Nature. Now, this is a remarkable guy. He convinced us we're not eating enough fruits and veggies, even though we thought we were. Now, you don't need to eat the stuff you don't like. Turn to the Balance of Nature solution instead. Can you imagine how you'd feel if you were eating 10 servings of fruits and veggies every single day? So Debbie started first, and I'm doing it too. Here are our bottles. This is the fruits. Actually, it smells like fruit. It's kind of cool. It pops open. Wow. And this is these are the veggies. So we take 6 daily capsules and we're set. Debbie loves how they smell. We get all the vital nutrients sourced from 31 fruits and veggies every day. Debbie also swears by this. This is called the fiber and spice powder. And she says she's never been more regular. Join us and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. You need to use discount code AMERICA. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com. Don't forget to use discount code AMERICA. I'm back with Sohrab Ahmari, the author of an important book, The Unbroken Thread, which talks about the importance of tradition, a kind of deeper understanding of liberty than we often hear in America. Sohrab, you have a very interesting analysis here of the notion of Gnosticism. Gnosticism is sort of this idea that there's secret knowledge available to certain people, but it's also the idea that the mind is noble and the body, the physical body, the biological body is somehow corrupt and ignoble and degraded. And I was familiar with Gnosticism as a sort of early Christian and post-Christian tradition, but you apply it remarkably to this modern phenomenon of transgenderism, where people basically say, I am what I say I am. So in other words, even if I am biologically a man, I can look down at myself and see that I have all the male characteristics, but I can sort of declare myself a woman, as if to say that my physical body didn't even matter. It has no say over me. And it's a triumph, I guess one could call it, of psychology over biology. Say a word about how we've reached this ridiculous point where we seem to reject even the obvious visible imperatives of nature.
Yeah, I mean, the deformed idea of freedom, which says that freedom is something that is opposed to the restrictions that we get from either nature or tradition, that the more I reject those two things, nature and tradition, the freer I am and I get to define myself, reaches its kind of apotheosis, its absolute logical end in the transgender phenomenon. And as you said, there's a clear echo of the ancient Gnostic heresies, which insisted that the human being is, what is truest about us is a kind of divine spark that happens to be trapped in this fleshly apparatus of the body. And so the Gnostics all had a great disdain for bodies, embodiment, nature, which is treated all as filthy and horrible. And in a strange way, this Gnostic idea has found a stubborn new expression in modern accounts of gender, where I am, as you said, I am not the body I receive from nature, contrary to what Genesis and genetics tell us. I can will myself into being something else, or that there is a kind of trapped interior me that is at odds with my body. And so it's a very old heresy, and it's a very old temptation.
You make a point about tradition and how even though tradition can impose limits, and you use the example, of the Sabbath, the idea that by law, let's say, for example, bars have to be closed on Sunday. And you say this seems like a restriction, an offense against kind of modern liberalism. Why should I be deprived of my right, for example, to buy alcohol on Sunday? But talk about how a Sabbatarian law like this creates a new type of freedom, so that limits and freedom are not opposites, but limits sometimes allow you to experience freedom in a new and maybe more profound way.
Yeah, so the Sabbath, and this nation has had a Sabbatarian tradition, the idea that the law should uphold one day a week as a day of rest and being with God, has had it before there was a republic. In other words, the colonies all had these restrictions. And the restrictions only went away over the course of the 20th century, with the last blue law being abolished in 2019 in North Dakota, statewide blue law. And it was sold, as these things often are, as a triumph of choice. You know, I don't have to do one thing on Sunday. You can shop, you can socialize, you can work. In practice, though, we see that the loss of the Sabbath has actually left us more harried, has left especially working class people at the mercy of what's called algorithmic human resources scheduling, where there's no kind of regularity in how much and when they can spend time with their children. Some days it's on Sunday, some days it's Saturday night, and there's kind of no rest of life. So it's really been liberty for Jeff Bezos, it's been liberty for the Amazon warehouse manager. It's not been liberty for the family, for the worker.
Sohrab, how do we get back on track here? It seems like the country has succumbed. I mean, right now, it's not just that we're fighting the classical liberalism that essentially, you may say, genuflects at the altar of liberty. we're fighting against this woke liberalism that has its own puritanism built into it, if I might say so. It's coercive. It has its own vocabulary of good and evil. It imposes ancestral guilt. You know, every white person needs to feel like an oppressor and so on. I mean, do we need something on the order of a religious revival or a third great awakening? I mean, virtue and tradition are wonderful, but you can't go to someone and say, you know, you need tradition. But you can go to someone and say, you need Christ. So is it the case that the mechanism for restoring virtue is really religious conversion and religious reawakening, and that short of a third great awakening, it's going to be very difficult to do the things that you beautifully and movingly advocate in your book?
Well, I agree with you that basically evangelizing the culture and exhorting people to virtue and telling them about Christ is very important. But I think that this work that we're talking about does have a political dimension. That is, we have to be willing, conservatives, traditionalists, Christians, and others have to be willing to use power, because as Aristotle says, mere exhortations to virtue aren't enough if there's no kind of formative work that the law and politics and society are doing. And so in a lot of these cases right now with the woke that you're talking about, it doesn't just mean saying, well, woke ideas are bad, which they're so moronic that you and I can obviously see that, but it means curbing the power of these private tyrannies, these corporations right now that are imposing that. And that's political work. That's not merely exhortation to virtue. You know, if we can't even propose the idea of Christ because we'll get banned on Twitter, then we can't really begin to even exhort people to virtue. So we have to limit the power of, I see as the greatest threats to, you know, even the classic American liberties right now, the greatest threat comes from these agglomerations of corporate power in the likes of Twitter and Facebook, which would, you know, if they could get away with it, they would ban both of us, Dinesh, tomorrow. And they may yet, who knows. But so there is an element of dealing with a kind of political and material substrate of society before we can even get to doing the kind of work of exhortation that you're talking about.
So, Rob, this has been very eye-opening and illuminating. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
In April alone, consumer prices increased by 4.2%, the highest bump since 2008. Higher fuel prices, higher food prices, construction costs, housing prices. Hey, inflation isn't just coming, it's here. Have you protected your savings, your investments? If you've not yet diversified a portion into precious metals, the unfortunate answer is no. Now, for years, actually decades, I never invested in gold, just the stock market. But now I'm seriously worried about the regime we have in Washington. Absolutely no sense of fiscal responsibility. So listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a bit of a ticking time bomb. Invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Now, Birch Gold Group is who I purchase from and who you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right, through a little known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs, or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold like I did before it's too late. I want to talk in this segment about the death of Thomas More and the writings of Thomas More when he was locked up in the Tower of London awaiting his execution. Now, who is Thomas More? Well, he's a saint. He was the Chancellor of England, a very close friend of the King, Henry VIII. Henry VIII demanded of Thomas More that he make a public statement and sign a statement approving his marriage, his second marriage, to Anne Boleyn. Thomas More refused and was sentenced to death in a kind of trumped-up trial. By the way, the story of Thomas More is the basis for one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Hollywood a film ever made called A Man for All Seasons, starring Paul Scofield. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but you should. And why? Because in partly it shows you the kind of great movie that Hollywood once knew how to make. I don't believe Hollywood today could make that kind of movie. But there was once a Hollywood that commanded not just respect, but even awe. And that Hollywood, I'm sorry to say, is now perhaps gone forever. I've seen Man for All Seasons, well, probably 5 times. And I can recite whole sections from it. There was a famous scene where Cromwell, the kind of diabolical bureaucrat who wants to frame Thomas More, brings in Roper, this kind of young stooge that he wants to give false testimony against Thomas More. And he goes, I know a man who wants to change his woman. He goes, normally a matter of small importance, but in this case, the man happens to be our liege Lord Henry VIII of that name. And he goes on to say, that if a powerful man like that wants to change his woman, he's going to, and our job as bureaucrats, says Cromwell, is just to minimize the inconvenience. Thomas More was a big inconvenience, and that's why they put him in the Tower of London. Now, this brings me to what I want to talk about, which is Thomas More's writings in the Tower. First of all, he writes the, it's called A Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation. Now, this is a very interesting case where words in Thomas More's time don't mean what they mean today. Comfort in those days didn't mean ease or peace or taking it easy. No, comfort actually meant struggle. Comfort meant to strengthen, to work against. So a dialogue of comfort against tribulation means how do you toughen yourself up against the execution that is to come. And Thomas More writes this beautiful dialogue about a young man who has been captured by the infidel Turks and has been and society is unraveling around him. And you can kind of see the parallel between this Christian man imprisoned by the Turks and what is Thomas More slyly implying? Well, he's implying that the infidels today in his day is actually the king himself. And his court, that King Henry VIII is acting, in a sense, like a Turk and using, if you will, false charges against him. More also writes a beautiful meditation called On the Sadness of Christ. And you can see here how More is thinking about Christ at Gethsemane, the sadness of Christ, and equating, if you will, or learning from Christ's passion. Again, the word passion here doesn't mean passion like desire, but rather passion understood more as suffering. Thomas More writes a beautiful letter to his young daughter, Meg, who's obviously going to be facing the prospect of life without her dad. And he says to her, farewell, my dear child, and pray for me. And also he consoles his wife. And then, and this to me is the most remarkable thing, Thomas More writes a letter to his persecutors, the very people who put him in the tower, the very people who have arranged for his execution. And he says, quote, to them, though we disagree in this life, disagree, what a euphemistic way of putting it. Though we disagree in this life, I hope we will nevertheless agree in another life. In perfect charity. It's almost like Thomas More is saying to these bad guys who have rigged a trial against him, he's saying, hey, you know, we have a disagreement, but you know what? Maybe we just didn't figure it all out. Maybe in another life we can sit back down and work out this in a reasonable way. What a way to think and what a way to talk. And then he goes on to say this, I verily trust and shall therefore right heartily pray. Thomas More is going to pray for what? That although your lordships have now here in earth been judges to my condemnation, we may yet hereafter in heaven merrily all meet together. Wow. Thomas More is saying that he doesn't wish that his persecutors and tormentors pay for their sins. He doesn't want them to be in hell. In fact, he's going to pray that they not only are in heaven. I mean, you think it's one thing to say, okay, listen, I hope you repent and get to heaven. But, you know, frankly, I don't want to see you there. He goes, no, I hope that not only will I see you there, but we'll be able to sit down and laugh and kind of have a drink, spiritually speaking, perhaps, and kind of make merry together. So this, I think, is the true spirit of Christian charity. I confess I don't always have it. I aspire to it. But sometimes when I think of the little petty tormentors who went after me, it's very hard for me to think in Thomas Morian terms about them. So I constantly want to keep these kinds of writings in view because they are a true embodiment of Christ's instruction to us to like him, love our enemies, and do good to those who hate you. Earlier, I mentioned my Dinesh special, which is if you buy $250 or $500 or $1,000 of MyPillow merchandise, you're going to get some signed books and some signed movies from me, autographed personally to you. Now, you've heard me talk about MyPillow, but Mike is always introducing new products, and his latest one is My Slippers. These are amazing. Mike has taken 2 years to develop these slippers designed to wear indoor or outdoor all day long. They're made with the MyPillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue. They've got this beautiful quality leather suede. And for a limited time, Mike is offering 40% off his new My Slippers. Now, these My Slippers are so comfortable, you're going to want to get some for the whole family. In fact, here's a great idea. Buy them early for Christmas gifts this year. We actually did. Here's Danielle, by the way, with her moccasins. Debbie and I got, we just love ours. I got the moccasins. Debbie got the slip-ons. Go to MyPillow.com and click on the radio listener square and use promo code Dinesh. You'll get deep discounts on all the MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream bed sheets, the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow towel sets. Call 800-876-0227. Don't forget to use promo code Dinesh. Time for our mailbox. By the way, send me questions, audio or video preferred, to questiondinesh@gmail.com. Today's question is from Caitlin. Listen.
Hi, Dinesh. This is Caitlin from Michigan. I know you've done quite a lot of debates in public speaking in the past, and I think that's a very useful skill to perfect. So when did you become interested in public speaking? When did you start? And do you have any tips or advice for people who might want to get into that? Thanks for your thoughts.
Caitlin, you're awesome, and I'm glad to have another question by you on the podcast. Keep learning and keep growing and developing. Now, interestingly, I began speaking even before my books. I was in the Reagan administration, and a fellow came around and said, hey, guys, would any of you, he's talking to the policy staff, like to give briefings for the White House? And turns out that in the White House, you have people who come all the time, Fulbright fellows from Africa and, you know, nuns from India, people who are coming to meet the president. They often get just a minute or two with the president, but the White House organizes a kind of program for them. And so they ask staffers to do briefings. So I volunteered. And some of my colleagues were like, oh, Dinesh, we're making policy over here. Why do you want to waste your time giving briefings? And I thought, no, it's actually really good experience for me to talk to very diverse groups of people from different walks of life, defending the Reagan administration's domestic as well as foreign policies. And so that's kind of what got me on the speaking trail. Later, when I published my first book, Illiberal Education, I literally had kind of overwhelmed like 400 invitations to speak at various universities. So my initial speaking was on the campus. Later, of course, I began to speak to civic groups, the World Economic Forum, Republican groups, Lincoln dinners, all that kind of stuff. I'll just give you sort of one tip, Caitlin, in preparing for talks and for debates in particular. It's really important to be able to listen to what the other person is saying in a debate, because very often people have points to make and I want to make my point. And so because I'm so eager to get my next thought out, I'm not listening to what you have to say. But it's only when you listen to your opponent that you can get to the heart of the matter. And by the way, if your opponent makes 7 points, don't feel like you have to refute all 7. You really don't. Pick the point that you think has resonated most with the audience. Dunk on that. In other words, crush it. Leave it in smithereens on the floor. And basically, people will write off all the other 6 points without you having to deal with them. So that's just a little debating tip for the future. I hope this is helpful to you, and I hope it's helpful to all of you listening to this and watching it as well.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and Salem.